Hiya.
Welcome to another episode of the Stinging Fly podcast. I'm Danny Denton. I'm the editor of the Stinging Fly. And we're coming to you today from a workshop 5 in the top floor of the Crescent Arts Centre in Belfast. And we're really lucky to be joined by Wendy Erskine. Wendy is the author of Sweet Home, which has been, at this point, and I think it's still less than a year old, long-listed or short-listed for the Republic of Consciousness Prize, the Gordon Byrne Prize, and the Edge Hill Prize. Hi, Wendy.
Hello there.
Can I ask you first, before we hear about your story, where do you like to do you read a lot at home? Do you read on a commute? And what kind of things do you like to read?
Well, I read, yes, I would read mainly at home. So I'd mainly read in the same spot where I do my writing, sitting at the kitchen table with my back against the radiator. I always have my same chair. And I would read all sorts of stuff, novels, short stories, non-fiction, a lot of books about music. Some ways I'm not a very good reader. I'll often read the ending first because I hate to be surprised. And I would never read a short story collection in the running order. I would always mix it up a bit. So
shortest story first, or is that just me?
Yeah. Well, I would look and think, oh, look, I have to go and pick my son up at such and such a time. What's the shortest story here? Yeah, I'll pick that one. I'll read that one now. Yeah.
Fantastic. And what have you chosen to read for us today?
Today I've chosen a story by Adrian Duncan called Prozenetsky. And that's the story I'm going to be reading today and talking to you about, Danny.
Fantastic. A brilliant story. So, first of all, Wendy's going to read it for us.
I took the ball over my shoulder, hoping it would land just inside their box, because for the last 20 minutes, their centre halves had been pushing up the park, and our right winger, an earnest young man on loan from a large Scottish club, had been making a succession of diagonal runs across their defence. But the older centre half, Thirlwell, a guy I played with years ago, had seen immediately what I'd tried to do. He'd backtracked and hacked my pass back over our heads, returning it down the field. The ball, a sphere of ivory in the night sky, had gotten lost in the floodlights, reappeared, bounced, and our keeper, Arterbury, had come out to catch, but had been upended by their centre forward, a lanky and sly operator called Cooper, who is top scorer in our division and on his way up the leagues to a more prestigious club and enormous wages. Arterbury is out cold. That frightening dead man inertia came over his body when he landed, and the ball just rolled off his stomach. Our medics rushed to him. I jogged towards the sideline for water and to loosen out my knee, which is stiff with painkillers and permanently destroyed. It mocks this puerile comeback of mine as a half-time substitute in a mid-table game on a wet, pointless night in late March. Our manager, a tall, bellying Londoner, looks at me as I trot over. Then he looks away. I'm 35 next month and returning from a recurring injury that most would have retired on. It's not that I need the money as such. I've been careful over the years, but if I can get another contract at even half of my current wage, I'll be able to buy a fine two-bed apartment back home in Leeds, one I've had my eye on for a while now, one I can rent out and make a few extra bob off after I retire. I scoosh water into my mouth and onto my face and peer around at the crowd of 7,000 or so. The few hundred of travelling support are tucked away up in the north stand, but the whole place has gone utterly quiet, with everyone fixating on Arterbury splayed on the ground amid plumes of vapour and hunkering medics. Our stadium is an old thing in the middle of a small city in northern England, a city surrounded by long, still steel and ironworks and a network of congealing canals. I often think the fans come here just to be among the decaying trusses that hold up the roofs of the deep, single-tiered stands. Old men and women with their grandchildren people the seats, and pockets of pale and overweight blokes on cheap season tickets who obsess over transfers gather in a sprawling sky blue and white horde across the south stand. This club was never great, and seems to exist now only out of the ghost of some habit. The rain is spinning in thin films down out of the black, over the edges of the roofs of the stands, and through the large rectangle of floodlights that frames the sky. My breathing is modulated and my heart is thumping coarsely. Our home supporters' voices come up as Arterbury gets to his feet. They're chanting one of the club's old classics, something about being on a beach in Barry. It's a sort of over-unionised chorus that has begun of late to sound like a lament. I've been here 6 years, but for the last three, I've been more injured than not. Yet the supporters love me. They're limited but committed midfielder. I play as they would play. I scored in my debut in a cup quarter-final against their rivals, a club across the city, now two divisions above us. I played well the first two seasons, scoring double figures and keeping us in the middle of this lower league. Then I hurt my knee during pre-season, a torn tendon, a repeat of one I picked up when I was 23. That first knee injury came days before I'd been meant to sign a contract at a big club in the top division. When I left, emptied out, the club recommended a knee specialist in Munich, to whom I went for 10 months, over and back, with no club and no wage and diminishing savings. I regularly bumped into another young midfielder there, a German guy called Michael, a polite, slight, muscular chap who played in the second division for a small club outside of Berlin. We chatted about swimming and gym work and the Bundesliga and went for lunch on occasion. Once my knee repaired, he convinced me to travel up to his club. And with no other offers on my plate, I decided to trial and do a pre-season. I got fit again, became strong and played well, so they gave me a two-season contract. They were an old East German club with a large following of what looked like mostly neo-Nazis to me, but they had a beautiful stadium in the middle of a vast forest that shoehorned around a dark, deep and peaceful lake. I was in my mid-20s then, and after 8 months finding my rhythm, I became as rapid, nimble and healthy as I'd ever been. I never really drank, and almost none of the Germans did either. Some of them smoked, and a Turkish player, Umut, would sometimes take me to his parents' cafe in Wedding, where we'd puff happily for hours on a shisha. Other than that, I spent my afternoons after training sessions visiting erotic massage parlours in town, local, Thai, Latvian, after which I would drive back out to my spacious apartment, prepare dinner, read and sleep. Being injured and being a good professional over the years had taught me how to suppress my energy between games and to live as a lesser god. I soon learned some football German and began dating a local girl called Stephanie. But during winter break in my second season, while on holiday with her in Kos, I slipped on the tiling beside the hotel swimming pool and ruptured a ligament that, in the murk of my knee, neighboured the one I'd torn before. I didn't play again for a year. I blamed Stephanie and stopped seeing her. I focused furiously on getting well again, but what disappointed me most was that it had happened at a time when I'd been dictating games, when my circle of influence around the team had widened and become more intense. My personality then had been extending through the field of play, sometimes into the opposition's shape, and my opponents couldn't dismantle it, no matter how hard they hit me. My Englishness had become exotic, and my range of passing had broadened in that forest in Brandenburg. Short, quick, unlikely passes, and long cross-field pings that switched play emphatically. I'd been casting out nets of influence over the pitch that allowed my inner city Leeds swagger to appear. And when it did, a nutmeg, a no-look pass, it was cheered brutally by the loving crowd. I'd wave to them at the end of games and they'd howl back at me. I'd learned each teammate's preferred foot and how they liked to receive the ball. My tackling had become crystal. I almost never went to ground, staying on my feet and waiting for the opponent to panic at the gaps I kept filling. I once went 3 games without losing a ball. I scored 8 times during the first half of that season, but more than anything else, my footballing intellect had begun to develop at a great rate. I wasn't just picking out passes before the ball came to me. I could see the pass after that as well, imagining the game three vectors ahead of the fluxing present. I'd become a roving pivot between our defence and attack, and had begun to intuit when the opposition started reading me and would mix my play up between passing or keeping the ball or turning on it or holding. I'd begun playing from a viewpoint at once far above and deep within the eddies of play. In short, at this lesser but accomplished level of football, I'd approached some genius. Before each game, I'd watch the grainy videos I'd collected since my teens of my favourite player, the tall, blonde Croatian Robert Prosinecki. Then I'd lie on my bed, close my eyes, and re-visualise his movement. When he lifted his head, when he controlled the ball, rolling it under his foot, the way he used his body to shield himself, and how he spun away from bewildered defenders at the least likely moment. I analysed him when he was young and turning out for Red Star Belgrade, then kings of the soon-to-crumble Yugoslavian leagues. I modelled my play as a young man on the brio I detected from him. But once I'd recovered from that third knee injury, I found that my body had tightened and I couldn't meet the demands of his style. I fell away as a footballer and changed from a creator of good ambition to one of near none. One night, 2 weeks before I snapped my ligament in Kos, we'd been playing a team from Cologne. Midway through the second half of a tight, nasty game, I received a pass that had been zipped at me from our left back. I'd been on the midway line with my back to the opposition's goal, and as the ball sped to me through the sleet, I feigned right and clipped the ball with the inside of my foot back across my body and past my left knee. Then, feeling the entire earth rushing over my right shoulder, I spun left, and the pitch, the stadium, the lights, the forest cleaved open before me. The crowd's voice surged as I pushed the ball towards the developing frames of possibility. Both of their fullbacks were way beyond our wingers. One of their centre halves got drawn left while the other advanced on me, a tall ageing Pole, Gregor, who once played for his country at the Olympics. I ought to have shown him more respect, but I was young and full, and I knew my midfield partner Michael would be running hard in a shallow arc behind me. So I made eyes left and shaped a pass, but instead slowed, leaned back, and scooped the ball high and right. And as the ball arced insolently over poor, steadfast Gregor, Michael sped past me and advanced irrevocably beyond him. The ball bounced softly, and Michael took a touch with his instep, looked at the keeper chasing out, and rolled it to his left. The crowd bellowed. Gregor slumped on the edge of the box, head down, but Michael was off, swinging his shirt in the air, sprinting to the corner flag where the ultras had poured down savagely through the stand. Our left back jumped onto my shoulders and roared at the top of his voice while hurling his fist in the air. Then he landed beside me and we chased towards Michael and the rest of the players. I jumped onto the huddle and bared my teeth at the corner of broiling white men and roared banal non-words into them all. As I jogged back to the centre circle, the same thoughts I always had when I was playing well in Brandenburg appeared, that I could run like this forever, that there was no limit to my Cartesian aptitude, that I was a conqueror here, that I was showing my football culture to be finer, and that I was ready to return and present myself again in England, the only place where any of this had worth or made proper sense to me. It was the only place where the admiration was appropriate. And as my heart pounded and I tracked down their kickoff, I thought, it is the only admiration that will last satisfyingly beyond my career, where I might be recognised for my deeds as an ageing, broad-shouldered and bronzed ex-pro in my 40s and 50s and 60s, entering a cafe perhaps in some quiet West Midlands town, or a restaurant in Newcastle, or the clubhouse of a cricket club on a quiet Tuesday afternoon in a suburb in northern Leeds. Arterbury has had to lie down again. They're calling the stretcher from the sidelines, and an ambulance pulls up at the mouth of the tunnel of East Stand. Our substitute keeper, Wilson, a young Northern Irishman, is warming up with a heartless vigour. I wonder how many times he has wished Arterbury dead. Along the sideline, the goalkeeping coach drop-kicked shots at Wilson, who catches with a conspicuous mixture of method and what looks like instinct. He'll never be a great keeper. He's too in love with technique. But he will earn well and convince many. I imagine when he's much older, should fortune offer him a moment of lucidity, he will look back on his sporting life as a mechanical insult to his trade. He runs onto the pitch, fisting his gloves, as Arterbury is carried off. Arterbury, prone in the stretcher, lifts his arm to the crowd, who cheer as if he were a miner lifted from a blast. The referee gives a drop ball, which Cooper steps up to and hoofs disdainfully into the crowd behind our goal. They jeer. Cooper jogs, then strides back up the pitch and turns for the kick-out. And as the players gather around the centre circle, like steaming cattle awaiting feed, he looks over his shoulder, smirks, makes a, "What can you do?" type shrug at me. If I were younger, I'd aim to nail him before the end of the game. But there's too much at stake. And though the crowd may bay their approval, the manager would see through it. And if I get a red card, he'll strike me from his reckoning for the next three games I'm banned for, and then, most likely, for the rest of season two. I look to the seats above our dugout and spy an ancient Irish gentleman, Lawrence, who's not been to the ground for some time. He used to be a coach at my old schoolboy club. He was a goalkeeper then and had large, beautiful hands and white, slicked back hair. After training one day, I was 14 and Leeds United had invited me to their academy for the summer. I stayed behind to practice with one of the other boys, Graham, who was as sweet a footballer as I've ever seen, but never came to anything. As we walked back to the clubhouse to change, Lawrence appeared and asked me to walk with him. It was raining heavily as we strode over and back along the centre line of the pitch for almost an hour, him advising me about going to Leeds at this age and the sort of lads I'd be up against and how many people fail there. But that is how you take the failure and what you learn from it that contributes to you as a footballer. As your body and mind develop, he continued, particularly in your central position, and if you're wise and lucky, you will get a sweet spot in your career when your body can carry your developing footballing mind, and your mind will in turn push the body beyond what you thought possible, creating new positions, new patterns, new time, he said, with rain pouring down his face. And you will feel this moment for a brief period in your life, son, and you must remain limber enough to feel it, to act and expand on it. This sweet spot, he continued, will happen during a game when the contours of adrenaline, exhaustion, familiarity, daring, and a recent history of good physical condition coincide. And you must treat that moment, or these moments, with a cavalier preciousness and make them your own by making them memorable for those looking on. And if you can do this, son, even once, truly, then, he said, you would have achieved something as a footballer. He is sitting in the stand now under a sky blue and white hat. He looks old and cold. My stomach turns. My knee trembles. I think how wrong he was. I think how foolish I have been too, for believing for years in that crap. And for believing too that that moment against the team from Cologne was the high point of my vocation. When in fact I realise, jogging across the centre circle of the pitch, barking orders at our left winger, that it was my lowest point. Throughout my career, I'd so focused on moments in games when the aesthetic effect took precedence over the pragmatic decision that I'd failed to realise through watching Prosinecki for all of those hours that it is the pragmatic that serves the aesthetic, that it is only from the core of good service that any beauty can bloom. If I'd analysed Prosinecki properly, I'd have seen that his decisions were always at the service of what was necessary as he faced the manifold problems emerging before him on the pitch. Even though the most beautiful pass might be available to him during a game, he always chose the most effective, the one that few footballers ever see or do see, but are too vain to take, playing in clichés of what is great, hitting entertaining passes, passes that are similes without sentences. But Prosinecki, as if playing for no crowd, always made the most moral decision on the ball. He solved the problems on the pitch in a way that developed the moment back upon itself, but with one small alteration that split the game open. And each alteration he made was balanced and fair and furthered an abundance that each game was already germinating, an abundance that did not require an opponent to be humiliated, an appropriate abundance that I, and everyone else who speaks of him, has misinterpreted as flair. This, and what I up to now have perceived as the high point of my career, are two shades of the same ugly daub. And I realise my very worst crime was what I thought was my very greatest moment, the one those supporters in that small club near Berlin will remember me for forever. I would do well to go back and apologise to Gregor and to everyone who witnessed it, and to disown everything in my life that led to it and beyond it to now. But there's nothing I can do, and no way for me to repent. I am a spent, age-thickened footballer, mooching around a large circle with a line through it, in the middle of a city I care little for. Wilson is shaping to boot the goal kick up the pitch. Then he spies our right back dropping deep to take it off him. He rolls the ball out, and because Arterbury didn't try this during the game, our opposition is out of shape to receive the attack. The right back turns out with the ball, raises his head, and with a dumb, morphinic excitement, I spy a gap opening towards the right side of their box. I take off, and our right back floats a cultured backspinning pass up the channel. And as I sprint, I can see my fellow midfielder come across to meet it. His shoulders arch, his neck muscles slacken, and he glances the pass off the top of his head. The ball loops gently into my bending path and skims out in front of me, and I sense my opponent behind as I chase towards where the ball will bounce again and skid and roll, and I feel like I'm clear and free. A silence comes over me as I take a touch, but the touch is terrible and has put me too wide, and the ball has gone too long and my right leg has been clipped, and I should really go to ground, and I can hear the crowd scream for me to do so as if nothing would make them happier. But to my left, I glimpse our striker, a young, athletic Liverpudlian, powering alone into the box. And if I can clip the ball across to him, he will surely score. I know if I fall, I will be reconnected with my past. So I straighten, and my legs, out of dumb momentum, begin to gather and re-coordinate beneath me, and I realise that if I propel myself and stretch for this disappearing ball and dink it back across the box, that somehow I will have done enough. I lunge, feet first, and scissor my right foot desperately at the base of the ball. As I connect and slide over the line, I can see the ball spinning handsomely back up and away from me towards a space in front of our striker, whose eyes and mouth have widened, his arms have spread, his feet have skipped, his knees are bent, and he lifts himself diagonally up to where my cross is going. The ball begins to slow into its languid arc, and as our striker's body coils, and as his eyes wince shut, bringing him into the great pre-impact dark that every footballer knows, I gasp deeply, once more, at the impotent, incidental and unforgivable beauty of it all.
Thank you, Wendy. What a story. This is a story about an aging footballer, a journeyman, I suppose you'd call him, during a break in play in a game. ruminating on his life up to that point. What do you think is the deeper, what's going on at the deeper level in the story for you? Why did you connect with the story so strongly?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I am not a football fan by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I don't dislike football, and I've actually enjoyed a lot of books about football, you know, in the last number of years. I mean, things like Ross Raisin, A Natural, I thought was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was brilliant. And I've loved David Peace on football. But with this, I took this to be a story about football in one sense, but really to be a story, I thought, that was to do with art, and was to do with not competing ideas to do with art necessarily, or oppositions, but different sorts of ideas to do with art. So a kind of, you know, if you want to look at it in an elevated way, I suppose a kind of like Dionysian, Apollonian kind of opposition that you've got there, you know, on the one hand, you know, clinical, calculated, pragmatic, versus, you know, flair, adoration, aesthetic, ego, all of these sorts of things going on. So you've got two competing ideas there. The narrator there expresses it as the pragmatic versus the aesthetic, and you could express it other ways as well, but that's what I thought it was actually dealing with. It was basically, like, to me, a story of, you know, he's got the two models there, where he's got his idol versus the way he's been playing, trying to impress the crowd and, you know, grandstand showboating at times. It's like, you know, Charlie Watts versus Mick Jagger, you know. Edgar Linton versus Heathcliff. I mean, this is just a type of opposition that crops up over and over again in art and literature. It's like Tracy Emin versus somebody like Kathy Wilkes, I think. So it's that type of idea. I thought it was really interesting what I had to say about that.
It's really interesting that you mentioned a couple of the Greco-Roman kind of ideas as well, because I had that exact thing in my head when I was reading it, that it was kind of a tale of youth versus experience in one sense, like that. Mm-hmm. Now he's the older guy and he's looking back, trying to attain this kind of platonic ideal within that moment. But it's also all taking place in a crumbling stadium, in a crumbling empire, and he refers to the crumbling Yugoslavian league. So there's this, I almost felt like I could have been reading a story about a traveling soldier or something looking back on his career.
Yeah, I think it's very, very equivocal. I mean, I think that somebody else that had read it said to me they thought it was very romantic about football. And so it's true in the sense that you've got the beauty is used frequently, that word, and it's used in the final really important sentence and so on. But to balance all of that, everything's crumbling, the stadium is on its last legs, he's in pain constantly. You know, there's something very inelegant about it. At the same time, this person who can perform with tremendous grace also slips at the side of a swimming pool. You know, it's really inelegant at the same time. The fans, there's constantly quite negative language applied to the fans, that they're braying, that they're brutal.
And I'm thinking of the Colosseum. When I hear those fans with their chants and things, I'm thinking of the Colosseum straight away.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. And another thing that it strikes me, you mentioned slipping by the pool in Cos. It strikes me as a very physical story as well. It's something you don't often get in literature, or at least not the literature I read. Like the body as well. Actually, you might get it in books with female protagonists, right? Or feminist books, the body as currency versus the body as the ideal and beauty and things like that. But you don't often get it in terms of an aging footballer who's falling to pieces, looking back on when he could move, like, It was like when I could dance, kind of.
Yeah. And he's only 35 as well. I mean, he's not even 35, actually. He's not even turned 35 yet whenever he's speaking here.
Which is, you know, I'm the opposite of you. I'm a huge sports fan, and I'm 36. And I played a lot. I play a bit of soccer, and I played a lot of Gaelic football. And at 36, you're over the hill, you're done, and you're watching all these young guys who are attaining this beautiful ideal of, like, it's like Neo in the Matrix, you know what I mean? They can manipulate fields of play, and they're like 20 years old or something. And that really, it's kind of, that's one of the real kind of sad is the maybe the wrong word, because he kind of does seem to have his head screwed on. But that's one of the real momentous things in it for me, is that kind of sense of, I now know what I should have known all along, or something like that.
Yeah. But at least I suppose he has this moment of redemption right at the end, where he realizes what he should have done, and then he does that at the very, very end.
Yeah, you know? And it's a beautiful way.
So he doesn't do what the crowd wants him to do. He doesn't go down there. He makes the pragmatic pass.
Yeah, and also he, like, that's utterly gripping as well, because you're thinking, please don't injure yourself. Please don't injure yourself. What else about the story? I mean, were there technical and stylistic elements that really impressed you, or was it that overall feeling?
Yes, there were technical, stylistic elements for sure. I mean, one of the things that I just find really interesting reading short stories is how people manipulate time, because I think you can elongate time, you can have sort of like a subjective, objective time, and you can sort of, you know, concertina it as well. And the fact that this is kind of taking place in the present tense, almost like real time, during a match, but yet we also are in his 20s and his experience in his 20s, and also as well his experience as a teenager when he's talking to Lawrence, the old Irish gentleman. And that's done really seamlessly to me. I mean, that's something I'm always looking out for, because I like that. I like myself always trying to run to maybe three or four timelines, but it's how you move between those timelines in a seamless way. You need to be like, I don't know, a DJ mixing or whatever. You don't notice the next tune coming in.
And it's difficult, isn't it?
It's very, very difficult to do it without it seeming quite clunky. But I think that's done really, really brilliantly here. I also think as well that there's a kind of a... The rhythm of this is often really very beautiful in an unshowy way. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's when I've said this is a story about art, in a sense to me, and also about football, but it seems to me also to do with writing, in the sense that what it's saying is that the aesthetic can't exist just purely for its own sake. It must be doing something. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we have here is, it's not bravura, it's not showy, it's not kind of like glitzy writing, show-off writing just for its own sake. You've got rhythms there, but it's done in a really subtle type of way. And I think as well, at times, time almost slows down here. You know, times whenever the ball's in movement or people are making a very fine kind of motion, time slows down really, 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 really effectively. And I think it's quite like, I don't know if you read Adrian Duncan's book, Love Notes from German Building Site, but it's the same thing again, where, you know, small actions and movements and things that you might not think are particularly exciting, like, you know, pouring concrete, the way it is handled and the way it's described, it becomes very, very gripping. So I think if somebody said, oh, I'm not interested in football, I don't want to read a story about a guy, you know, playing football, I think the way this is handled here would make it a really interesting read, regardless of whether you're that specialist interest or not.
That artistic link is so interesting to me, because as someone who really likes sport and tries to play it well, and who my body can't do the things that I would, as increasingly so, it never could, but it can't do the things, it can't do the ideal things that it sees, and with less and less frequency is it even close to possible. And I often feel the same if I'm writing something, like I've tried to describe before, like when you start writing something, I don't know if this is the same for you, you have this ideal, and it could be a narrative ideal, like I'm going to write a story about something that happens to something, or I'm going to write a story where I try to replicate this feeling that I have inside me. But whatever, whether it's a feeling or a narrative or an image or a line that you have overheard that you want to kind of give a story to, it's perfect. Before you touch it and try and write it, it's perfect. And the more you try and write it, the more like you, I often feel like I'm failing it, or when I'm writing really well or when I get very close, I feel like I've done it justice. Mm-hmm. And he has that exact experience in terms of trying to manipulate the game to make that perfect pass. Mm-hmm. And that pragmatic moment at the end where he doesn't do the pretty thing, but they get the goal, or it seems like they're about to get the goal. He gets it right. Yeah. It's like this art, there's an artistic joy, and like, I worked really hard to achieve it. I've thought a lot about it and I've done it.
Yes, exactly.
And you would get that feeling when you finish a piece of work that you're proud of, right?
Yes, absolutely. But I think what you're saying there, you know, he doesn't do the pretty thing, or he doesn't do the thing that is going to entertain the crowd or is going to whatever. He does a pragmatic thing. And quite often, I think with writing, the pretty thing is the thing you probably actually need to get rid of. Because in terms of what Adrian Duncan's saying here about the pragmatic, or the, you know, it has to serve the aesthetic. You know, quite often the pretty thing is the ego thing. It's like, look at me, look what I've done. It's not great. You know, I think he uses a literary analogy where he says that, where is it?
It's the one about the similes.
Yeah, passes that are similes without sentences. So, not that a simile sort of really high order literary method, but, you know, it's the metaphorical thing.
But what's it doing for the story?
And if it's not doing anything, get it out.
But,
you know, I mean, I'm like that with stuff, that the things that I'm really pleased about, the times where I think, oh, that's pretty cool. That's probably the stuff that needs to be
eliminated. Yeah. There's a line you'd often hear, like a kind of a smarmy line that you would hear about an athlete, and it's a, he'd be good if he didn't stop to admire his own pass or his own shooting, you know?
Yeah,
and it's like that kind of, like you sit back and you write a lovely simile or something, and you sit back and you're like, oh yeah. And then three drafts down the line, you're like, what is that? What's that still doing there? It's completely useless. Reads lovely.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the artistic idea as well, it's a story of kind of moments. Like, obviously it takes place over just a few moments or a couple of minutes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But as you talked about Adrian Duncan in an artistic sense, and it's in my head, there's this kind of iconic imagery. There's the ball spinning, you know, in the night, the rain washing over the stadium. So it feels like a story of these, of really strong iconic images as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was reminding me, I don't know if you've ever seen the film, the Zidane film, Douglas Gordon film. This was reminding me a little bit, that very, very visceral experience of the lights and so on.
Yeah. Physical, imagistic. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great shout. Yeah. It'd be great to get Mogwai to do a soundtrack to this story as well.
Totally. I thought that, you know, the character as well of Lawrence coming in was quite interesting, because he was almost a sort of sage, older man, you know, passing on his advice, sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi style figure here.
Yeah.
And it was nearly like, it was reminding me nearly of Kipling or something at the end, whenever he's saying, you know, if you can do this, son, then, you know, you will be a footballer.
You will have made
it. And that's just rejected.
And I think that's the one really interesting to me, because I often find dialogue is what carries me through a story. I think that's the one instance of dialogue in the story, or close to dialogue. It's more reported, but it falls into his voice. And again, I'm very jealous of someone being able to carry such a strong story without really a word. It's all rumination until that moment.
And even then, it's sort of reported dialogue until the sort of second section of it. It's not full direct speech.
Oh, it's really skillful,
And it
ties back in again with that idea of youth versus experience, that actually he's recalling this, and he's 35 now, or approaching 35, and he's recalling this conversation that he had with an old man when he was, I think he was he 15 or 16 or something, 14 at the Leeds Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's again like this idea of moments ricocheting through your life. So like this, he had a moment with this guy who gave him a piece of advice when he was 14, and only now
Is he revisiting it and deciding to reject it?
Yeah. Marvellous.
Another section I thought was really, I mean, that whole idea I was saying before about it being, it's very, very balanced. I mean, it's never an absolute endorsement of the beautiful game, but it's never either absolute criticism of it. I thought whenever he was talking about, you know, that absolute amazing moment, as he thought then, later he went on to review it, but, you know, Cartesian aptitude, conqueror, it's all so kind of elevated, but he kind of thinks that'll sustain him in a quiet West Midlands town, or a restaurant in Newcastle, the clubhouse of a cricket club, you know?
Yeah. There's that classic thing about John McGahan gets wheeled out all the time, the local and the universal. Like, you can write a story without ever leaving your parish, and it can be, you know, it can be or like Kavanagh, what's that?
Epic.
Epic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's fantastic. It raised an interesting question for me about his identity, because it struck me that he was someone whose whole identity was poured into his playing career. But he makes several references to, if I can just be good enough to get back home and do it where it matters, mm-hmm. in my hometown. And then he has that, his ultimate goal, which is, you know, very kind of seems quite sad to me. His ultimate goal is that he's got his eye on that two-bed place and he wants to be known in a restaurant in Newcastle or whatever. So it struck me that actually his identity is kind of tied to place more than that. It might be like a subtle thing that maybe we don't.
Yes, I mean, I wondered about that, and I wondered if it was something, because obviously, you know, I'm coming to this as a non-football fan. Well, not that somebody dislikes football, but just like the non-fan. And I wondered if there are things in this story, that resonances that perhaps I didn't get because I don't have a very kind of, you know, finely calibrated sense of this. So, you know, I was wondering, is there something maybe about English style of play versus German style of play that meant he would be more appreciated by English teams or English fans or whatever than German?
It could, yeah, that could well be that he's gone to the continent and picked up a set of skills or a set of abilities that he can then makes him a more attractive prospect back home or something. Definitely that's a possibility. It was really interesting as well in terms of imagery, and crumbling empires and things. Mm-hmm. He has this very special time in his career, a year I think, in a beautiful stadium in a forest in the woods in Germany. It's almost fairy tale-esque.
Yeah. You know? And I mean it's fairy tale-esque, but yet they're also, they've got the neo-Nazi supporters. So, you know, for every single one of these things, it's beautiful. There's also a kind of a flip side to it.
Yeah.
But as you say, I mean, that section there, then feeling the entire earth rushing over my right shoulder, I spun left, the pitch, the stadium, the lights, the forest cleaved open before me. I mean, that's magical, isn't
it? Yeah, and that's... he's facing this kind of transcendence, like that he has transcended the idea that he's open, or he's approaching eternity with his skills and how hard he's worked to get to this point. What about the title? You've got the correct pronunciation, but I'm pure Cork, so I'm going to say Prosinecki. What's the relevance of the title, do you think?
I think the relevance of the title is that... this is the lesson that he has learnt, that that for him that type of pragmatic, you know, the pragmatic serves the aesthetic, that's what he's decided is the important way round, and that's what he learns. You know, it's not to do with flair. He says brio. The word he uses earlier on is brio, and he says that wasn't actually what that guy was about. It was this kind of, you know, he's not motivated through vanity or trying to impress the crowd. He plays as if it's for no crowd, and he chooses the most effective rather than the pass that's like flash impressive to the crowd. So he learns that.
Going back to the idea of the iconic again, he learns this lesson through a focus on his own icon, the guy that he watches grainy footage of so often. That's fantastic. And just tying into short stories in general, I kind of think it's interesting to ask this whenever we have a brilliant short story writer on. Are there particular elements that you think are hallmarks of a great story in general? Like, or do you think a great story can be anything?
Anything, right? I really do dislike the idea that, I mean, there's all these art of short story, you know, discussions, events, and I'm not slagging them because it can be incredibly enjoyable and really interesting and so on. But it can also be incredibly prescriptive as to what a short story needs to do, how it needs to, you know, shape up, or, you know, do people need to discover something or whatever. I think a short story can do anything, and the best thing you can do is try to read it on its own terms, and if it works for you on its own terms, then that's really good.
That's all that matters. And this is certainly, well, it worked for both of us, this one.
Yeah, certainly did.
I should say that the story is called Prosinecki. It was published in issue 38, volume 2, in the summer of 2018, and it's by Adrian Duncan, whose book Love Notes from a German Building Site is out now with Lilliput Press. Wendy Erskine has been our guest. She's the author of Sweet Home, which is published by the Sting and Fly Press. Thank you very much, Wendy.
Thank you so much, Danny. Thank you.
So you've been listening to the Sting and Fly podcast with me, Danny Denton. It was produced by Ian Mellini, and we couldn't do it without the support of the Arts Council. So we thank them too. We'll be back next month. And if you liked what you heard, please do feel free to subscribe.